This is Jason Falls, author of Winfluence, Reframing Influencer Marketing to Ignite Your Brand, and you're listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, and thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. I do this podcast to help me and my listeners keep up with the latest ideas that matter most in the quickly changing and somewhat overwhelming world of modern marketing and sales. My day job is running a marketing agency that helps manufacturers and industrial companies grow their revenue. To learn more about the problems we solve and how we do it, visit salesartillery.com. All right, enough yakking. Let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Jason Falls to talk about his book, Winfluence, Reframing Influencer Marketing to Ignite Your Brand, published by Entrepreneur Press. Jason Falls is a leading digital strategist, author, speaker, and thinker in the digital and social media marketing industry. An award-winning strategist and widely read industry pundit, Jason has been noted as a top influencer in the social technology and marketing space by Forbes, Entrepreneur, Advertising Age, and others. A 2014 Forbes article named him one of 10 business leaders all entrepreneurs should follow on Twitter, alongside Richard Branson, Mark Cuban, Tom Peters, and the late Tony Hsieh, and me. Now, I'm kidding about the last one. I was not on that list. He is the author of two other books, No Bullshit Social Media, The All Business, No Hype Guide to Social Media Marketing, co-authored with Eric Deckers, and The Rebel's Guide to Email Marketing, co-authored with DJ Waldo. Jason is also noted for founding SocialMediaExplorer.com, the top marketing blog in the world, according to Ad Age's Power 150 in October of 2010. And interesting fact, his first real job when he was 12 years old was delivering the newspaper, and one day while on his paper route, he pulled someone out of a fire, saved his life, and was later awarded the Boy Scout Medal of Heroism Award. Jason, congratulations on Winfluence, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Well, thank you. I don't think my mother could have read that bio better.
Well, I'm proud of you. I was a Boy Scout, and I was always prepared and always looking for opportunities like that to help, but fortunately, I never had that opportunity. So I first learned about your book when I was interviewing your friend Neil Schaefer, who wrote, he's written a couple of books, but the last one was about the age of influence. Mm-hmm. And in that interview, he said, oh, there's two other really good books coming out. One is Amanda Russell's The Influencer Code, and I later interviewed her. And then he said, and Jason Falls has a new book coming out. So it's all coming together for me with this interview. I've got all three of you. It's the hat trick.
That's great. And those are two great books. I have both of them sitting right above me on my shelf. I've read both of them one and a half-ish times and refer to them frequently.
Oh, great. Great. Well, they really were. And I learned so much more about influencer marketing, which we'll talk about. But Jason, I've got to make a confession here. And you don't know this, but I'm about to tell you. I've been following you for years, stalking, call it a man crush, whatever. And about, I was less than 10 years ago, I saw you at a conference in Boston. I think it was an inbound conference. Mm-hmm. And it was one evening after one of the keynote speakers had finished talking and the big rush of people came out into the lobby. And I came walking out and I saw you sitting in a chair like you were waiting for someone. And I walked by you and I thought, oh my God, that's Jason Falls. And I kind of slowed down and I thought, oh man, I ought to go introduce myself, tell him I'm a fan. And then it's like one of those things where you see a celebrity and you think, oh, come on, let's be cool. Let's not bother the guy. So this is the first time I've actually gotten to speak to you. I wish I had come up and introduced myself, but often when I do that with someone like yourself, security gets involved. So it's, Doesn't always end well.
Well, the problems with your story are I'm nowhere near a celebrity. I was probably waiting for someone to come up and say, "Hey, I see you on the internet. Let's go have a drink." So right. Probably should have taken advantage of it.
Yeah. Oh, great. Now I know. We're going to talk about drinking. I do appreciate the autographed copy of your book. I collect autographed marketing and sales books. You know, people like you probably collect, you know, sports memorabilia from West Virginia University or something like that. So you have a really, I know you hear this, you have a really entertaining writing style. And I enjoyed it very much. And then in the acknowledgments, I believe you mentioned that a writing inspiration of yours is Dave Barry. Is that right?
That is right. The first real writing job that I ever had, I moved to New York City right out of college, and I'm from a really small town in eastern Kentucky. And so that sort of juxtaposition of worlds was interesting enough for the local newspaper to ask me to write a column. And I said, I'll write a column for you as long as I get to be funny, because Dave Barry was kind of like my literary hero at the time, I guess. And I wanted to be a humor columnist. And so they allowed me to do that for a couple of years, and then they got tired of my sense of humor and fired me. But yeah, I love Dave Barry. I love anybody who can be clever and fun and funny in their writing, and try to bring a little bit of that attitude toward my writing too. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But
well, I think it worked in this.
Most people find it entertaining.
Yeah, that's terrific. Well, they're lost. How are they doing these days? So, you know, I had to laugh on page 33, and we'll get to the book in a minute here. But you wrote, much of my day-to-day work is in the spirits industry. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was funny because much of my work day is in the spirits industry. Mm-hmm. I don't work for the spirits industry, but I do a lot of free product testing for them at my desk. And I should mention, did you know, you probably didn't know this about me, and I don't mean this to be talking about me, but I have diplomatic immunity.
I did not know that.
You're talking to a Maker's Mark brand ambassador.
Ah.
Yeah. So, somehow they got in touch with me, and I think they found out from the local liquor distributors where there was a lot of their product being sold, and then they traced it down, and now I get these trinkets from them, and here I am talking about them. But in your book, you talked about all these bourbon brands you've worked on, other brands too, but like 1792, Buffalo Trace, Pappy Van Winkle, Maker's Mark. And you also worked on Jim Beam, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. So my first agency sort of role, back when I first started, getting into this whole social media digital marketing thing, because I was a PR guy in college athletics for 15 years prior to that. But as I got out and into the mainstream marketing world, I worked at Doe Anderson, which has been Maker's Mark's agency of record for probably close to 50 years now. And, of course, Maker's Mark is owned by Beam Global. So the U.S. director of whiskeys at the time at Beam Global said, "Hey, you're doing all these really cool things with Maker's Mark and social media, blogging, things like that. Why don't you also, lend me some expertise on Jim Beam and a couple of other brands for our portfolio?" So I got the opportunity to work on, a lot of different brands. We did a really nice, sort of social media video campaign with Jim Beam back in the day that won a Sammy Award, which was one of the first awards that, gave social media recognition. And so won some awards and had a really good time working with those brands. Unfortunately, when I left Doe Anderson, I kind of sort of left the bourbon clients for a while, but I've been at Cornette now for about 4 years, and Cornette works very closely with the Sazerac family of bourbons. And then at a stop in between,
Bourbon brands are those? Is that
so? That Sazerac family of bourbons is anything basically made at the Buffalo Trace or the Barton 1792 distillery.
Okay.
So you got 1792 bourbon and Thomas S. Moore bourbon at the Barton 1792 distillery. And then at Buffalo Trace distillery, you've got Buffalo Trace, Eagle Rare, Weller, E.H. Taylor, Pappy Van Winkle, Blanton's, Benchmark. There's several brands that.
Okay. Well, slow down, because I'm going by the liquor store after this, and I'm making a list here. Yeah. Wow. And you are a bourbon drinker.
I am. When you live in Kentucky as an adult, it's hard to not be.
It's required by law, isn't it?
I think, yeah, we have a punch card. You have to, about every 3 days, if you don't get it punched, you go to jail. So
yeah, or they send you to another state.
Exactly. Might send you to Tennessee to drink that swill.
Oh, yeah. A little bourbon throwdown here on the Marketing Book Podcast. So, well, yeah. Jason, I mean this, in the most sincere Ferris Bueller way, Jason Falls, you're my hero.
Well, I resemble that remark.
Well, so now just one other idea. You work with all these bourbon brands, and I saw in the book that you've also done work for Stearns and Foster, the mattress company.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever thought of doing like a promotional tie-in with a bourbon brand and a mattress? Because one always leads to the other, at least for me.
Yeah. After you've had enough bourbon, you need a Stearns and Foster mattress to lie down on and take
right.
a nap.
So yeah. There's no charge for these ideas,
Jason. That's a clever idea. I don't know that I've ever thought of that, but that's a good one.
Yeah. Well, you know, just something to think about. I don't need an answer right away, but, you know. Now, you mentioned in the book that you do have a son and a daughter, and just like I do. And just one other question. When your daughter was born, did you ever, like, for a brief moment, think about naming her Niagara?
No, I didn't. And I didn't because when I was a kid, people called me Niagara.
Oh,
thinking that was funny. And I was like, that's really not funny. And also not very original. So no,
none of my jokes are original, just so you know.
I didn't do that, but I will share this secret with you. Every now and then when I have a friend who goes to either Niagara Falls or some other, you know, waterfall out there, and they post a picture and they tag themselves in it, I'll comment and say, oh yeah, you should see Niagara at the family reunion. Drunk, handsy, awful. You know.
That's great. I wonder if they accidentally tag you because they're putting the word falls into the social media.
I'm sure sometimes they do.
Oh, right. My goodness. Well, let's get into the book here. And the foreword is by David Merriman Scott, who mm-hmm. Marketing Book Podcast listeners probably know because he is the patron saint of the Marketing Book Podcast. I know you've seen that on his bio. He was my very first guest back in January of 2015, wow. And I've interviewed him about six different books. Mm-hmm. And I've read, you know, as you can imagine, hundreds of these books, and gosh darn it, this is one of the best forewords I've ever read. and in a bit of a departure, I wanted to quote from it if I could.
Sure.
So he writes that, I'll pick it up where he says, in the middle of the pandemic, he was going through some serious withdrawal as it relates to travel. He writes, I visited 170 countries. I've been to all seven continents, all 50 states over a lifetime of travel. Under normal circumstances, I've got as many as a dozen journeys booked to look forward to each year. However, by playing it COVID safe and not getting on an airplane for 8 months, my stay-at-home life feels strangely incomplete. So last month, I bought a tricked-out 4x4 Mercedes Sprinter camper van so I can do some self-contained travel with solar and diesel power, plus a 21-gallon water tank feeding a small kitchen, toilet, and shower. I can live off-grid for a week. Prior to my big purchase, I would never have learned about camper vans if it hadn't been for several people in my network, those people who influenced me, who were talking about them. That led me to a private group on Facebook that I joined, and for a few months, I read every post about the sort of camper van that I, by then, had become obsessed with. I paid attention to what the more experienced people had to say, and they influenced my decision to buy a camper van of my own. However, I was doing my research. I also encountered people in the Facebook group who represented brands or who appeared to be paid influencers. Most of their posts felt like a sales pitch, so I dismissed them. And based on the very few numbers of comments on these posts, so did others in the group. There's no doubt that without the influence of the people I encountered in the camper van Facebook group, I never would have purchased one of my own. I was influenced. Celebrity spokespeople have been around for decades. In the 1950s, before he entered politics and was elected governor of California and president of the United States, then actor Ronald Reagan, for many years, was the host of the General Electric Theater, a popular weekly TV show. People felt they could trust him, and sales of GE products enjoyed success as a result. Fast forward to today, and add the super easy ability to create content via social media, and all of a sudden, many people influence others. Companies are obviously eager to tap into those people who have influence over the buyers of a particular type of product or service, or who are popular with a particular group of people, and build marketing programs that will attract them. But how do you do that? Well, you can just pay up. Many companies invest a lot of money on celebrities who become paid spokespeople for their brands, frequently through posts by the celebrity on social media. However, paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to have one of the Kardashians wear a piece of jewelry to an event and posting a photo of the evening on social feeds isn't likely to lead to sustained sales if she isn't perceived as a true fan of the product. Or You can find an up-and-coming influencer who charges way less than the Kardashians, who will happily shill your product on their Instagram, complete with duck-faced peace sign and a fabulous background filled with palm trees and a swimming pool. There is a better way. What you really should do instead is listen to my buddy Jason tell you about what he cleverly calls Winfluence. And I'll stop there, but I just wanted to read one other thing from the beginning of the book. You write, Winfluence, reframing influencer marketing to ignite your brand, is not merely a checklist of tactics. There will be plenty of explanations of how to do influencer marketing, but all that is framed within the concept of Winfluence. Winning with influence marketing means you must apply marketing strategy to the action of influence rather than simply spell out tactics to take with influencers. So, just so folks know, this is not a book about how to become what you and David called duck face peace sign Instagram influencers. And that expression was mentioned a few times in the book. So clearly it's an issue for Jason Falls that I think we should explore. So let's get in touch with your feelings, Jason. What is the problem with influencer marketing?
Well, I think the problem with influencer marketing is you've got a lot of people there. Right now, one of the most popular responses to the when someone asks a teenager or a kid, a child, what they want to be when they grow up, the answers are now, I want to be an influencer. I want to be a YouTuber. I want to be an Instagrammer. And there's nothing wrong with that because those are viable professions. But I think because so many people, I think the reason that kids are saying they want to be that is because there's this perception that all you have to do is post pictures of your food or pictures of you with your, you know, showing your peace sign with your duck lips pouted out while you stand in front of a fountain somewhere, or Photoshop a background of Bali behind you or whatever. And that there's a perception out there that exists because there are a lot of influencers who are doing just that. They're, quote, living their best life. And what their best life is they're basically, you know, just sort of posting these glamorous pictures of them in locations that they can't afford to go to, wearing clothes that they can't afford to buy, wearing accessories or driving cars that they could not be in a million years. And they're faking this life, thinking that that's going to get them sponsorships and whatnot. Unfortunately, sometimes it does. Because brands don't always do a great job of investigating who these influencers are, who their audience is, do they actually move their audience to take an action? And so there is this subsegment of the influencer space out there that is this very superficial peace sign, duck lips, you know, faking the life, faking the background, and they're not real substantive. Unfortunately, the mainstream media typically focuses on that narrow subset of influencers when they write stories that business owners and whatnot see in the mainstream media. If you're not a marketing geek and, you know, read the blogs and listen to the podcasts and study this stuff like maybe you and I do, and you're just a business owner, the only thing you see about influencer marketing is that these are superficial, ineffective, peace sign, duck lips people that I don't want to spend any money with. I happen to know that 80% or more of the world of influencers out there are actually great content creators who can motivate their audiences to do things with your brand, because that's what I work in every day. So the problem is we've got a misperception of what influencer marketing is, and we need to rethink how we look at influencers and influence overall so that we can understand how to use it strategically for our businesses.
Okay, Mr. Influence Marketing, let me ask you this, and I'm going to quote, so everyone knows it's not really me, but I'm quoting from page 12 because I think I've been in this situation. You know, you're sitting in a conference room full of people with their arms crossed thinking, what is this guy talking about? And you're right, I can hear you skeptics in the back thinking, influencers, schminfluencers. Nobody actually pays attention to these people. And those peace signs and duck lips don't equate to business metrics like sales or revenue. And then you write, you're not just wrong, you're damn wrong. Mm-hmm. Jason Falls, please explain.
Well, you look at any of the research that's out there right now on the effectiveness of influence marketing, or more broadly, look at any of the research out there from, you know, like the Edelman Trust Barometer and other places that say, that ask the question, where do consumers get their product information? Where do consumers go when they are trying to decide, you know, what to purchase or how to make a purchase or what brand to buy? And all of those statistics point to influencers as being incredibly effective. 63% of people out there trust influencers for product recommendations. And in this context, influencers are people with large networks, large followings on social media. The 2019 Edelman Trust Barometer said, you know, that 74% of people don't look at ads anymore. That number, I think, has gone up a point.
I think they actively avoid them.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, there's a little difference there.
Yeah, I know I do. So if 74% of people don't look at ads and you are spending money on traditional advertising, whereas people who are sort of hip to what consumers are doing are spending money on things like social media, content marketing, and yes, influence marketing, then you're probably going to be missing out, especially if your competitors are doing it and you're not. Estee Lauder is, you know, one of the biggest, you know, fashion style beauty brands in the world. And in the quarter Q4 shareholders call in 2019, their Fabrizio Freda, I believe is the name of their CEO, came out on the call and said 75% of our marketing budget, which by the way is over $1 billion, 75% of that marketing budget is spent on influencers, not on social media, not on digital marketing, on influencers. And so it's obviously a ripe avenue for the picking because that's where consumers are going to get their product recommendations.
Mm. And on page 144, you mentioned that only 1% of millennials trust advertising. I mean, I'm not surprised. I don't. That's just one of the lowest numbers I've seen for that. But let's go back to those doubting Thomases and let's say, okay, well, we're just going to do PR. We're going to reach out through the media. And on that same page where it's got all these really shocking statistics, 60% of Americans anyway, polled, believe that reporters sometimes or often get paid by their sources to write stories. So, and you go on to write that 69% of U.S. adults say their trust in the news media has decreased in the past decade. Mm-hmm. And 46% of consumers around the world say they do not have much trust in traditional media, meaning newspapers, magazines, TV, and radio. And then it goes on to talk about 74% of consumers intentionally avoid advertising. So those kinds of statistics have helped me to understand why this is one of the most effective marketing means out there, but I think there's probably years or at least a generation of people thinking about, I'm not going to do the duck face peace sign thing, but this works a lot in B2B. And I think you even mentioned in the book that software as a service companies are really some of the best at this. Is that right?
Yeah, they are. And that's, you know, I've had this opinion for a while. And as I keep lobbying it at people in the marketing industry who sort of know the B2B, you know, influencer marketing space, or at least connect the dots when I ask the question, everyone seems to agree with me. But if you go back a good decade, if not more, in the software as a service world of, you know, the Oracles of the world and the Adobes and whatnot, any software out there that's providing you with marketing services or business services, how do they generate their leads? They typically generate their leads by hosting webinars or doing white papers or research reports that you have to sign up for. You have to give your name and email address in order to get that information. And then they put your contact information into their marketing funnel and they work you down the funnel, right?
Well, or work you over.
That's true. They could do that too. Well, what is it? You know, who's providing the expertise for the webinars? Influential people, people who are thought leaders in the industry. Mm-hmm. Who's providing the quotes for the white papers and whatnot? Influencers within that particular space. So B2B folks have been doing this for a long time and have actually kind of, you know, screwed the screws so tight that they've gotten it down to a science to where they know if they pick the right influential person to do the webinar and they market it a certain way, they can predict how many leads they're going to get because they've done it so many times and done it so well. So I would argue in many aspects, B2B software companies probably do influencer marketing better than any B2C company does, even the ones that spend $1 billion like Estee Lauder. Mm-hmm. So it works in B2B, it works in B2C, it works for large businesses, it works for small businesses, but it only works if you approach it strategically and sort of plan out your attack of who you're going to use, why you're going to use them, what you're going to ask them to ask their audience to do, and so on.
Yeah, I remember at Content Marketing World a few years ago, there was an influencer track. And in a moment of weakness, they asked me to moderate that. And it was, you know, to introduce all the different speakers. And one of the big things I learned there was that this idea of you're not buying an ad one time. You need to build a relationship with these people. And one of the best things that can come out of this is continuing that relationship. Do you see a lot of this short-termism with companies?
Yeah, that's probably the biggest problem right now, especially in the B2C space in influence marketing, is that people are still thinking of this as let's just, you know, have the influencer post one thing about us and see how it does. Well, you know, again, it's like, okay, well, let's play one radio advertisement on the morning show and never place another ad and see how that does, right? There's a reason that advertising success comes with reach and frequency.
Yes.
And so if you're going to look at it from an advertising perspective, you know, having one sponsored post with an influencer is ridiculous. It's just a waste of your money. What you need to do, and this is where the sort of advertising approach needs to bleed over into what I would call the public relations or the relationship building approach. You need to blend those two concepts and say, look, we want you to talk to your audience about our product with from the advertising perspective, but we want you to talk to them about it in a very genuine fashion over time so that they get to understand that you really believe in this product, which is a much more long-term investment. So the one-off sponsored content with an influencer is going to get you some reach, but it's not going to get you frequency. And if you don't have both, then it's not going to persuade the audience.
Yes. Well, let's introduce perhaps a new vocabulary word. I want to quote from page 22 where you write, "The indicators are there. So is the data. Consumers give a damn about influencers. Enlightened brands know this and give a damn about them, too. And while we've presented a valid reason for this, that traditional media is less trusted, or at least less consumed, there is a still more compelling answer to the question, why?" So explain the concept of surrogation. And full disclosure, I did not know that term.
So surrogation, I mean, obviously, I think everybody can kind of connect the dots and say, okay, that's related to the word surrogate, right? And so a surrogate is you're basically using someone else's experience to inform, you know, your decision or what you plan to do. You're sort of living through them, if you will. And so the concept of surrogation is really just using other people's experiences as a guide to your own behavior. And so that's the exact concept behind ratings and reviews, right? Why do we trust consumer reports? Why do we go look at the reviews on Amazon before we purchase something? We've never bought that product, but we want to make a decision as to whether or not we should. So we go look at the reviews to see, okay, what are other people saying? Well, that is surrogation. We're trying to make a decision based on someone else's experience. Surrogation becomes a very powerful thing in influence marketing because, again, you've got consumers going to influencers, you know, consuming their content. It might be for product information primarily, but it might also be because they like that person's lifestyle, they like their content, they like their entertainment value, their sense of humor, whatever. But if they are going to that channel as opposed to going to television or radio or print or magazines, or newspapers or magazines, then you partnering with that influencer creates an experience that influencer is talking about that allows their audience to have a surrogate relationship with your product through them. And so again, it's fishing where the fish are, right? The people are paying attention to influencers or a specific influencer, if you will. You partner with them over time to send a message consistently to allow their audience to say, oh, okay, this person who I trusts this product, uses this product, and I have a surrogate relationship to that product through the influencer. So that's going to put that product higher on the list of things that I might want to try or buy when I get to the point of deciding to purchase something in that world.
An example of that would be me. I am a hunter, and I am often looking at different types of equipment, and I don't believe anything on the websites of these different companies, these different manufacturers, whether it's ammunition or backpacks or anything. But there's a guy that I know, John McAdams, and I'll include a link to his big game hunting blog, and anything he has on there, I trust. He does all the testing himself, and he's given recommendations on just what works, what doesn't work. And he doesn't usually trash products, but he shows which ones work really, really well. And that's pretty much the first place I go to. And then if he does recommend something, boom, that's the first thing I'll buy. And I don't know what his relationship is, but I think he has a podcast as well, but he'll say if something was provided as a test. So, you know, it's just, it really, I thought about that as I was reading this, and I've mentioned him before when I was talking about Amanda, when I was interviewing Amanda and Neil about their books.
Well, wait a minute. Let me do you one better. The people that are listening to this podcast right now, you are their surrogate for marketing books.
Yeah.
They listen to you to say, well, I'm not going to go buy this book unless I feel like it's going to be good. You know, Douglas is interviewing this author or has interviewed this author. I'm going to go listen to that before I make the purchase.
Yeah. And let's be real clear. Let's disclose fully. You did not offer me any bourbon to be on this show, right?
I did not. I might buy you a drink at some point, but I have not offered.
Right,
no.
Right, right.
I sent you a copy of the book. That's
an autograph copy.
I did autograph it, but my autograph's not. It probably devalues it a little bit.
No. You know what? One time, I've interviewed Kai Kawasaki a couple times, and he came to my town and gave a talk, and I met him there, and I said, hey, can you autograph my MacBook? And he said, yeah, but you realize that's going to decrease the value of the MacBook. So anyway, he's a very funny guy. So let's go on to one of the bigger concepts in the book, and that is the difference between influencers and those with influence. So the difference between influencers and those with influence. And having read your book, there seems to be a yawning divide between the two.
Yeah, there is. And it's funny because in the editing process of the book, my editor said, look, you really have to go through and make sure all of these references are right, because I make that determination early in the book that I'm not going to talk about influencers anymore, because influencers are people on social media networks who have big audiences. With the R on the end of it, influencer, that's someone who has a bunch of followers on Instagram or Twitter or YouTube or whatever. And those people might very well also fall into the other category of being influential, but they also might be the peace sign duck lips folks that you don't want to deal with, right? Mm-hmm. So just having a lot of followers is not the qualifier. What you want to do when you are strategically choosing the people that you want to partner with is you want to choose people who are influential over whatever audience they influence. And so I'll give you a couple of examples of what I mean by that to sort of explain why the follower count is not your primary concern. Again, there are plenty of influential people out there. And I spend the entirety of one chapter talking about a young lady called whose name is Ari on Instagram, A-R-I-I. And she is a fashion style influencer. She's a young lady. She was a teenager. I think she might be 20 now, but she's very young. And she has built a couple of million followers on Instagram by posting pictures of her in different outfits and in different locations around, I think, South Florida, where she lives. And she's very beautiful, and she has these really interesting outfits that she wears, and she does good hair and makeup and all that good stuff. But in her, the copy that goes along with her images, there's really just like, you know, live in large emoji, 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 right? There's not a whole lot of context or information that she provides. So she has 2 million followers. And so she thought a few years ago, now again, this is a teenager. I don't think that this is a bad thing. She was being entrepreneurially and thought, you know what, I've got an audience. I should try to come up with my own, fashion line. I'm going to come up with my own apparel, and I'm going to try to sell that product to this audience. Any other 17, 18 year old in the world who did that, we would applaud them for being an entrepreneur and being ahead of the game.
Yeah, she's going to do okay. She's learning. Yeah.
Exactly. But she came out and launched this product line, and then very notoriously now took it all down, because in the first week or whatever of having it up, she only sold 26 individual items. Now, 26 individual items out of an audience of 2 million people is horrible from a marketing metric standpoint. But again, this is a teenager trying something new. And I go through a chapter where I basically say, here are all the things that she could have done leading up to the product launch to make it be better. And hopefully she sees that and will learn from it, or will learn those things from other people. She may not read my book, and I'm not worried if she does or not. But I walk through all of the things that she could have done. And so essentially, she is an example of an influencer, someone who has a lot of people follow them for whatever reason, but she's not influential. She's not able to persuade them to do anything. Mm-hmm. And she proved that. And so the people who are influential are the ones that we need to focus on from a business or a brand standpoint. And those are people who we know have trust in their audience. We know that when they say, I like this product, I enjoy this product, I go to this event, I do this thing, their audience is going to be persuaded to at least consider, if not do that thing or buy that product or try that product, right? And so those same sort of six principles that Robert Cialdini wrote about in his book, Influence, which came out in 1984 or something, has been seven or eight different editions since then. But Robert Cialdini is kind of the father of persuasion, and a lot of salespeople love his stuff. I do too. His six principles of persuasion are the six things that I broke down about Ari that I think the people who have influence, who have real influence, they do. They have reciprocity, right? They give a little something to get something back. So if Ari had been giving of her style and fashion expertise, giving people makeup tips and things like that as, you know, sort of a freemium product that came through her content, then they would be more willing to then, you know, reciprocate and buy her shirts or her, you know, whatever apparel she had. There's also the principle of scarcity. You know, I've only got 100 items of these, so you got to rush out and buy them right now. There's authority, right? She just, you know, posted a couple words and emoji. She never established authority for style and fashion leading up to this this product launch by saying things like, you know, here's, you know, the latest, you know, red carpet pictures came out today. Let's break down each one's, you know, style and fashion and what would I score them on a scale of 1 to 10 or whatever. She never established her own authority as someone who knew something. She looked good. She wore things well. She had great style and fashion, you know, makeup. But for all we knew, or for all her audience knew, you know, she had a makeup artist and a stylist and a photographer and whatnot, and she didn't have anything to do with it. So there was no real authority there. And then there's the consistently providing that. Consistency is the fourth of Cialdini's principles of persuasion. And then, you know, liking. Is another one. You've got to be able to, you know, not only be likable, but also, you know, like things that you, your audience sees that you have in common, that you like the same types of things. And then that leads to the sixth one, which is consensus, building consensus that this person, this Ari, is someone who, is able to, you know, pull people together around a topic, which she wasn't able to do. But the people who do have influence have some sort, some combination of those things, and we can look at their content and understand, yes, they're going to persuade people to do something. They're going to have an effect on people. So that's the first part of it. And very quickly, the second part of people who are influential versus influencers is it doesn't necessarily have to be people online.
Yes.
if you're a local business and you sell products to, let's say, parents, then the president of the local PTA might be the best influencer you have, and you don't need to care how many people follow that person on Instagram. So there's lots of influential people offline that you can think about in this concept of influence marketing without the R on it, that can help you be successful, and that will break through all of the problems and stereotypes around influencers and influencer marketing that will help you succeed.
So I don't think going forward I'm going to use the term influencer marketing now that I've read your book. I'm going to say influence marketing. And was that one of your goals, maybe?
That was one of my goals. I would love for people to say, you know, influence marketing is using influence strategically. It's the verb. It's the action. It's what you want to do. You're trying to influence an audience to do something. You're not trying to influence her. That doesn't make any sense, right? You know, your goal is not to work with this person. Your goal is to persuade people to do something.
Yes.
So get rid of the noun, get rid of the channel, and start talking about what our goal is. We're trying to influence an audience to take action, and therefore it is influence marketing. And when you look at it as influence instead of influencer, then it encompasses online influencers, sure, but it can also encompass a lot of other things.
So you mentioned Robert Cialdini's book, Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion, which was written in 1984. And that book has been mentioned on more interviews on the Marketing Book podcast than any other. I mean, it's that great a book. And then here you've got a chapter on it. And Jason Falls, we're recording this on a Friday. Guess who I just interviewed on Wednesday?
Oh, you got to be kidding me. Really?
No, I got to interview Dr. Cialdini about his new and expanded book, of influence, and it's like 465 pages. I read it. It's been a big week of reading for me because I read Influence and then Winfluence. And and just out of curiosity, because that is the longest book I've had on the show, I thought it'd be interesting to see how long it took me to read it. I timed myself, 16 hours and 5 minutes. Wow. And it was some of the best time I've ever spent. If you know marketers only read a few books, that would be the one to invest in. And I mentioned that just 2 days later, I'd be interviewing an author who had a whole chapter about his book. And I guess he hears that a lot.
I'm sure so, he does.
Yeah, so it's very exciting. So we're really going through from influence to winfluence. It's as if I even planned this. You know, there was one tactic in the book that I think is really important, and Neil and Amanda talked about it too. And you talk about circles of influence. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, first off, people want to rush out and see how many followers someone has. Okay, so hopefully we've disabuse them of that. And at the same time, I think that people want to go find the news media, or they want to go find an influencer or whatever. And you write the first audience you should try to influence about your brand is your own employees.
Yeah.
And then go to your vendors and your partners. Can you talk about why that is actually a better route than trying to go out to the general public or influential people?
Well, I always feel like you need to start close to the bone, right? If your own employees and or, you know, their friends and family don't believe in you, who the hell else will?
Right? Well, you know what? Your customers might also.
Yeah, yeah. And you can definitely start with your customers too. So I start with employees because they need to be bought in. They need to be sold because they're going to help you communicate out to other audiences of influence in their everyday life, even if it's just their family and friends. Then you've got your vendors and partners, people that are invested in your business as well. They're going to be able to have an impact and influence on, you know, people on your behalf. Then your current customers come in there because now you're talking external instead of internal. And when your current customers get excited about you, now you're starting to talk about ambassadorship. You're starting to talk about loyalty. You're starting to talk about all of these sort of incentive programs and whatnot that help keep new people coming in because the current people are so happy they're willing to tell other people about it. And then beyond those audiences, the current customers, vendors, and employees, then you've got what I call influential people. And again, we're looking at this in terms of influence marketing. So influential people certainly could be, if you're in regulated industries, it's going to be the lobbyists that you might employ to influence the folks in your state legislators or Congress, et cetera, things like that.
A good point, Jason. It could be a very small number of people you're trying to reach, and that's okay.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And I mean, you know, for instance, in the world that I live in influence marketing, because I kind of do this as a practice, you know, I'm trying to influence a very small number of people, brand managers and people who, you know, spend money on marketing. I'm trying to influence them to spend money on this little niche sliver of marketing that is, you know, small in the grand scheme of things, but also critically important. So if I'm doing influence marketing for Cornette, the agency where I work, or for me as a consultant, then I'm only looking at a few dozen people that I really need to get on board with pushing people my way. And I'm a happy camper, right? Doesn't have to be everybody. You
know, it reminds me a bit of account-based marketing.
It is. In a lot of ways, it absolutely certainly is. You know, for a B2B situation where I work at an agency that has, you know, I would say, you know, Cornette's a small agency. We got about 50 employees. Now, certainly we would love to grow and be 10 times that size, but we can't be 10 times that size tomorrow. So we can't take on 5 new clients tomorrow without, you know, a little bit of pain, a little bit of growing pains there. Mm-hmm. So I would be really happy if I had 5 really qualified leads from having a conversation with someone or using influencers who can influence brand managers to say, hey, you should call Jason Falls about this. I'd be great if I had 5 really, you know, warm leads and only one of them converted maybe a month. That'd be really happy based on the size of the business I'm in. Now, if I'm at an Edelman and I've got hundreds of employees around the world, I can scale that. Mm-hmm. But not all businesses need to scale.
Yes. So you make it really clear. Again, this is another one from a big takeaway for this from this knuckleheaded reader. Influence plus strategy equals winfluence. Right. And my sense, and it was kind of confirmed in your book, that there just seems to be a dearth of strategy out there as it relates to influence influencer marketing. And there was as it relates to strategy, we can get into this briefly before I want to jump into these 6 D's that you have. But one of my favorite quotes was, without that ultimate sense of purpose and contribution to the overall plan, influencer marketing is just a dangling participle of tactical nothing.
I'm glad you liked that, because I thought that was pretty clever, and nobody at Entrepreneur Press underlined it or pointed it out and said, hey, this is pretty cool.
Oh,
I'm glad you noticed it.
Well, it resonated with me because of people like, you know, we're in the agency world, and just this idea of strategy, there's something about the human brain that wants to jump straight to those tactics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea of measure twice, cut once, a foreign concept to a lot of companies. So let me just read one other thing. And there is a process to this, folks. It's not lightning in a bottle. And much of the book goes into pretty granular detail about exactly how to do it. But you write, again, another one that I enjoyed is, you write, not planning to measure is like putting your family in the van, backing out to the end of the driveway, turning your seat, and asking, okay, where are we going on vacation? You haven't packed, you don't have plane tickets, you don't have hotel reservations, you didn't get cash from the bank, you haven't asked anyone to feed the cats. How on earth do you expect to go on vacation? Right. Oh, boy, that really stuck.
And the parallel there for brands is, if you are, you know, trying to figure out which influencers you want to use before you've decided what your goals are, then who are you choosing and why are you choosing them? Right. You're just rolling the dice and hoping, or and I've seen people do this. There's a great example. I'm going to have to anonymize this a good bit. There's a great example of a business that I'm aware of in my part of the world. They spend a good portion of their marketing dollars every year on a celebrity spokesperson. And the reason that they spend is not because that celebrity spokesperson will influence their audience to buy this product. It's because the CEO of said company wants to be buddies with the celebrity. That's the whole reason they use them. And any intimation from anyone to that CEO that they should not be doing this celebrity spokesperson because they can move more product if they spend that money in another way, and the CEO goes crazy. They're angry. Like, nope, I'm buddies with them, and we're going to keep doing it.
Oh, and you're not making this up, because I've experienced that too, and it's a real shame.
It happens a lot. But again, you have to approaching anything strategically, not just influence marketing, but social media or advertising or public relations or any other, you know, even outside of the marketing world, approaching anything strategically, you start with your goal. What are you trying to accomplish? Because the answer to that not only informs every answer that you'll need along the way to accomplishing that goal, but it helps you start planning to measure. So that when you get to the end, you know how you did. The biggest mistake that people make from a strategic standpoint these days in marketing especially is they wait until the end to say, how did we do?
Oh, yes. Well, that was, again, one of the best takeaways from the book is, before you do anything, plan on how you're going to measure it.
And if you do that, then what you end up doing at the front end, if you plan to measure, is you set these little data traps along the way. Mm-hmm. That will inform and let you know, hey, you're not moving up and to the right. You need to adjust something. Or you are moving up and to the right, but you could be doing it more.
Yeah, pour it on.
Or you're doing it great, just keep doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you don't plan to measure up front, you're never going to know the answers to those questions along the way. You're going to wait till the end and then have somebody go back retroactively and measure and go, oh, you know what? There was some data here a month in that told us we were screwing this up.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. I see this all the time. And this applies not just to influence marketing. This is like any kind of marketing. This is why it goes beyond this, folks. Let me just I wanted to touch on just these 6 D's that you have, because it really worked for me. I want to read that. And then we can talk about measurement and start to wrap up. But you, as I said before, it's not lightning in a bottle. There is actually a process. And you've even got some additional resources for readers. And we'll include a link to that on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. But just to give folks a sense of Jason's writing style that I so enjoyed. On page 74, he writes, "As cliched as it may seem in our link bait world, I still find lists and mnemonic devices to remember step-by-step processes useful. In chapter 5, we reviewed the 7 business drivers of social media marketing from my first book. These were the 7 strategic goals Eric Deckers and I determined from years of working with brands that social media could provide. So yes, I'm guilty of the occasional listicle or silly alliteration to remember things, but they work, so sue me. Building influence marketing campaigns, in my experience and practice, boils down to 6 steps. So if you'll excuse the repetition, I present you with the 6 steps to building influence marketing campaigns. Try to hear a dramatic Monty Python-esque trumpet blast in your mind each time you read that, and the mnemonic will stick better." So can you walk us through these 6 D's? And you know what? If you hadn't written it that way and structured it this way, I might not have paid such attention to this and remembered it.
I'm just glad you asked me to walk through the 6 D's and not do a Monty Python-esque trumpet blast.
Okay.
So... But yeah, so, you know, we just touched on deciding your goals. The first thing you have to do is decide the goals. So your first D is decide. Decide your goals.
Right. But let me ask you one quick question. Let me just interrupt, even though I asked you to start talking. You write, "Goals are usually not overlooked in digital marketing and social media, but they are often confused."
Yes, they are often confused. They're confused with, and it gets into the question of what are you, it's usually confused in the measurement process, because people want to look at KPIs, key performance indicators.
Yes.
And key performance indicators are just that. They are performance indicators that give you an idea of, are you moving along the line towards your goal? But most people will look at a KPI and think that that's the goal. So they're like, "Oh, we got 150,000 people in reach, or 150, our reach is 150,000 people this month. We have accomplished our goal." Well, no, your goal is to motivate those people to do something.
Yeah.
If you just got your message in front of them, well, go buy a billboard on the highway that 150,000 people go by every month, and you're going to get the same damn thing. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean they're going to buy your product. Right. So they confuse the KPIs with the goals. I would also argue that when people say, "Here are our KPIs," they confuse key performance indicators with performance indicators.
Yes.
I can promise you this. If you get a measurement report on just about anything in the marketing world that's more than a couple of pages long, like if you get a 95-slide report deck from your analytics company, then all you're looking at is a bunch of performance indicators. There's mm-hmm. there might be 3 or 4 of them that are key. Mm-hmm. If you can't sum it up in one page, you're wasting your time. Mm. I mean, you're basically just giving people charts and graphs to look at while they go to the bathroom. That's mm-hmm. all it is.
Is that what they do in there?
I don't know. It's reading material wherever they read.
Okay. Well, one other thing you mentioned that before you move on is you say choosing your primary goal and determining how to measure it takes careful thinking, but that is truly the most important part of your influence marketing efforts, the goal. So
it is. And it is because, again, that goal is your litmus test. Every question you ask, every decision you make along the way through the next, you know, 5 or 6 steps of this, the other D's, are going to be informed by the goal. If it does not get you closer to the goal, the answer is no, don't do it.
Well, before we go on to the second one, as it relates to determining success, could we talk about what you have in the book about the 4 real purposes of influence?
Sure.
Which are to persuade, to associate, to validate, and to enthuse. And I think if we could take a quick detour here and talk about the persuade, associate, validate, and enthuse, it might help get people closer to understanding what a real goal could be.
Sure. And so the after I go through the middle section of the book is all about the strategy. And then we talk about the 4 purposes of influence. And that's really what I consider the part of the book that says, okay, here's how these things relate to what you're doing today. And here are case studies so that you can see where the parallels are.
And it also seemed helpful, Jason, sorry to interrupt, but that it helps manage expectations of what influence marketing can do.
Sure.
So in other words, they say, well, we want more sales. Well, wait a minute. Sure, we want more sales, but let's measure some other things to determine if we're getting closer to that.
Right. So your persuade, associate, validate, and enthuse, which, by the way, spells PAVE as an acronym.
Ah.
So you're paving the way to success with influence. How about
that? Man, was that in the book? I missed that.
No, it wasn't. Oh. That's just, I figured that out later.
Okay, so what you're saying, Jason Falls, is that's a Marketing Book Podcast extra.
It is. It's an exclusive. I don't think I've ever pointed that out to anyone in talking about this book.
There you go, listener.
You have an exclusive. All right. So your persuasion. Persuasion as a purpose of influence marketing is most closely related to advertising, right? You're trying to persuade people with ads. Well, influence marketing can be used to persuade people. You can absolutely use influencers online or influential people offline or in other avenues to take a message to their audience that persuades them to try or buy your product, that persuades them to, you know, think differently about your issue, whatever it is that you're trying to go accomplish as your goal. The second one, associate, is much more closely aligned with public relations. Okay? Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily about primarily driving conversions. It's about associating your brand with a new line of thinking, with a community, with a group of people, with a type of lifestyle, right? And association, that's where celebrity product endorsements often come in, because a brand is trying to associate themselves with that celebrity. It's much more of a association public relations activity than it is an advertising activity, although because celebrities have to be paid a lot of money, it falls into kind of an advertising budget line. But it's really association. You're trying to say, look, we align with this type of lifestyle, which means that type of person is our target consumer who we're trying to reach.
So what would be one example that a lot of folks might know?
So I think a really good example would be, I mean, obviously, you know, Nike, you know, they try to associate with fitness, wellness, performance,
right,
you know, activity, right? And so you're not going to see Nike necessarily being involved with anything that's not about athleticism, that's not about power, that's not about strength, endurance, right?
So they'll sign an athlete and they're associated with them. Okay.
Exactly. Nike's probably not going to do a whole lot of endorsements of sumo wrestlers, I don't think. And it doesn't seem like it would fit to me.
I told them it was a big growth area, but they ignored me.
Was it a big growth area, pun intended?
Ah!
Anyway, so there's association. Validation is, you know, probably, to use a more traditional term that I don't necessarily use directly in the book, validation is really more about customer service, customer care. But the way it equates to influence marketing is ratings and reviews, right? Mm-hmm. It's that qualified third-party endorsement and recommendation of what you do and what you are. And so a purpose of influence marketing can be to make sure that there are people out there validating your product, rating and ranking and reviewing you.
Yeah.
And then the last one.
Wait, let me just interrupt one more time. Sure. With one thing that really surprised me. I was not aware of this. A lot of the SEO professionals might know it. But you write that the online reviews typically account for somewhere around 15% of Google's algorithm now.
Yes.
In fact, online reviews count for more than social media signals.
Yes.
And in most tests, even more than the on-page factors like keywords and titles.
That is true. And there's a really good reason why. If you go back, if you, you know, take away anyone's sort of biases against or for Google or any of the search engines, if you go back to the original sort of understanding of what Google is trying to do, they are trying to offer up an unbiased algorithm that will essentially rank content on the internet that answers the searcher's problem or question. Solves the problem, answers the question. And that ranking, if you know anything about SEO, you know that inbound links from third parties that are not related to you are very powerful. So if you have a link from the New York Times, which is a popular, independent, you know, media outlet, that is going to help lift the rankings of all of your links in a Google search, because this independent, trusted, reliable third party has linked to you, which is kind of a vote for your content, essentially.
Right. And not all links are created equal.
That is true.
And please don't buy links, folks.
Yeah, exactly. Because Google will find out about it and penalize you.
Big time.
But think about what a rating and a review is. And think about the ratings and review sites. So you've got Google My Business, where people can go and rate you. And so Google controls that. So that means a lot. So you need to make sure that you claim your business on Google and that you're asking your customers to go review you there. Now, Google will probably not be happy if they find out you're only asking satisfied customers to go rank you there, because again, they want this algorithm to show the honest truth about your product or service. Mm-hmm. So if you go to Yelp, if you go to TripAdvisor, if you go to OpenTable, if you go to Angie's List, if you go to Amazon, these are all sites where they pull in independent third-party customers, consumers, to rank and rate and review your product. All of those sites that I mentioned have terms of service that say you as a business or a brand shall not, cannot, and will be penalized if you do pay anyone to come and review you here. It's against the rules. Mm-hmm. Terms of service clearly state that. There are other ratings and review sites out there that paying an influencer to go and review there isn't against the rules. They're few and far between, but they do exist. But the one place that you can pay an influencer to review you, which still counts in the Google algorithm, is your own website. Mm-hmm. If you offer ratings and reviews on your site of your product, Google sees those links, Google sees those ratings, and Google takes that into consideration. So influencers can be used to affect that, but the reason that ratings and reviews have such a powerful impact on the Google algorithm is most ratings and review sites are trusted third-party, independent, non-paid, non-biased people, real customers, and that helps Google determine this is a fair ranking for this business.
Mm-hmm. So I stopped you. You were going to go to the last one, which was enthuse.
Enthuse. So that's probably my favorite part of this whole thing, because I love word of mouth marketing.
And yeah.
Enthuse as a purpose of influence is really, I think, most closely related to building word of mouth, building advocacy, building brand fans. And if you've got a group of influential people, be they online influencers or offline influencers, and you build a relationship with them and you provide products and services to them that they love and they love to talk about, they're going to turn around and be your first line of attack in building word of mouth marketing. And if we can all have great word of mouth marketing, then our marketing problems kind of solve themselves in a lot of ways, because we've got an army of people out there willing to turn and make a recommendation of us versus having to spend money to throw a message up there and hope people see it.
Yes. And let me add to that. You mentioned Ted Wright, mm-hmm. author of Fizz.
Yep.
Who has been on the Marketing Book podcast. And he's also from the South, like you and I, and he's a bourbon drinker. So it's all, you see how this interview is making it all come together for me. But he reminds us, and again, this is probably surprising to folks, that 70% of word-of-mouth conversations happen offline.
Yep.
20% over the phone, and only 10% of them are in the digital social media world. So remember that, folks. It's only about 10% of word-of-mouth is online. Doesn't mean you should ignore it, but there are other things you should be doing. And that just reminds me of your earlier point about, you know, a lot of influence marketing can be offline. I know that's probably heretical to some of these, quote, influencer marketing agencies. But, and also word of mouth marketing, there were some other statistics. I can't remember where they are, but they talk about how that is more powerful than just about anything else, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the research on that goes back all the way back to the mid-2000s, when I think it was Andy Cernovitz wrote the first real deep book on word of mouth marketing. Andy's one of the co-founders of the Word of Mouth Marketing Association. And the statistic that was always drilled into me when I was at Doe Anderson, and you mentioned this earlier in our conversation, the Maker's Mark Ambassador Program is one of the gold standard word of mouth marketing programs out there. And so at Doe, we believed in word of mouth marketing and advocated for it a lot. The statistic that was drilled into me back then probably isn't accurate anymore, but is still, you know, in the same vicinity. But the stat was that word of mouth marketing is 62 times more powerful than an advertisement. And I don't know how that was measured. And again, that was 15, 20 years ago now, when that was sort of drilled into my head. But in the book, I kind of go into a lot of other statistics about word of mouth marketing that are accurate and adequate today. I cite Talk Triggers, the book by Jay Baer and Daniel Lehman, which I know you've had on the show.
Yeah, and Daniel as well, with his book, Manipulated, all about online reviews.
Exactly. And so the word of mouth, sort of puzzle these days shows that, and I'm trying to find some of the statistics here as
I see one here on page 14. Yeah. It's where you talk about an engagement lab study anyway, mm-hmm. Revealed that 19% of a given brand's sales are directly impacted by people talking about it, while 40% are influenced by word of mouth. And there were some others, but it was really, you know, it's the first question I want to ask prospective clients is, you know, what kind of programs do you have to stimulate that?
Exactly.
It's so much more powerful, and also with amongst your customers. So, but that's about word of mouth. Now, I'll let you come back into the final lap here. So we were talking about goals, and it would seem to me that when you're talking about goals of influence marketing, think about that PAVE to try to get you off the KPI, you know, the KPI drug. Mm-hmm. So, and the next one is define your audiences.
Right. So now we're back to the six steps of building influence marketing.
Okay.
Decide goals. We're going to define our audiences. And I say audiences because you're going to define two different audiences. First of all, the audience you want to reach. Who are you trying to reach? What's the demographic profile? What's what are the social habits? Where do the people that you want to reach with your message, where do they get their information? And when you start to look at the influential people that you're trying to connect with, which is the next one, delineate influential people, you're going to want to define their audiences too, because where those two audiences overlap most is where you're going to find the most alignment and the most success. So where you have that overlap is where you're going to have the most success, where you're going to see the most, fruitful productivity for your efforts. So you need to define your own audience, but you also need to define the ideal audience of the influencer that you want to reach. That way, when you go to step three, the third D, which is delineate influential people, you can start with, does their audience align? Does their audience make sense? Then you want to get into understanding that influencer or the influential people you're trying to use to say, okay, what type of connection do they have with this audience? Are they persuasive over this audience? If they are online influencers, does their content align with the type of content that we produce? Does their content align with the audience and persuading them to do things? You have to really do a deep dive in here into understanding which influential people you want to use. You don't want to be the CEO who works with the influencer just because they want to be buddies with the influencer. You want to work with someone because they can motivate their audience to take action, whatever action it is you've determined to be your goal in the first one.
Right. And you mentioned an example of that was the Irish fighter, Conor McGregor, was hired to represent. I wasn't available. That's why they hired him for Burger King.
Right.
And it was a total disconnect. He has no connection with Burger King that I know of, or hamburgers.
Yeah. The only connection to hamburgers that I think I wrote in the book that Conor McGregor has is he can make your face look like one.
That's right.
You get in a ring with him.
That's right.
So he would not necessarily be an influential person for a hamburger brand or a restaurant that sells hamburgers. But someone like Guy Fieri, which is the example I use in the book, he's a chef. He has lots of restaurants. He knows how to make a great hamburger. There's a much better alignment there with your brand with that particular person.
Yes, and I don't know if it's true, but he may actually have a smaller social media following or whatever than Conor McGregor.
He may, but he's going to influence a lot more people to try.
Oh, yeah.
Thing.
The yield is going to be dramatic.
There's so much more credibility and trust there.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you've got decide goals, define audiences, delineate influential people. The next thing a lot of people say is, okay, now let's reach out and let's talk to these folks.
No.
What you have to do is you have to next develop assets. Now, you may have assets on the ready, and that's fine, but developing assets means you look at the influential people that you've delineated, you look at the goal, you look at the audiences, and you say, okay, what do I need to provide these influential people that will allow them to communicate my message well? And so if you put yourself into the mindset of someone who's a media relations person, an old PR person, right?
Yeah.
They're not going to reach out to the media and say, hey, will you cover this story? They're going to reach out and say, if you would like to cover this story, I have a photo of the CEO. I have quotes. I have charts and graphs. I have statistics for your story. I can put you in touch with these third-party people to give you information that will, you know, feed this story, right? You're going to give them assets that allow them to tell the story well. Now, the good news is that you're reaching out to, at least in online influencers, you're reaching out to people who create content. They know how to do it, but they don't have your logo. They don't have your videos. They don't have your pictures. They don't have things like that. So let's develop a little asset library to say, if we want to partner with you, if that's good with you and you're in alignment here with us, then here are the resources that we have to give to you to prepare you to do that well. Because the worst thing you can do is reach out to an influencer, get them all excited about your project, and then they say, okay, I need this, 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 and this. And you're like, well, that's going to take us a couple weeks to pull together.
We'll schedule a shoot. And,
right. That's going to kill your whole thing. So you need to be equipped when you go to them.
Yeah. Now, have you seen that happen a lot, though?
Well, I haven't seen it happen a lot personally because I like to be prepared. But
I mean, you've heard about probably from influencers who have been pitched. It's funny, David Merriman Scott, the beginning of the book, the part I didn't read, but he wrote, I wish more, because he's an influencer. Mm-hmm. He says, I wish all the people that reach out to me on a daily basis would read Jason's book first.
Yeah, it's something that you learn over time if you're doing this.
Yes, but
if you haven't done it much, you don't know any better, and you're going to make that mistake. So I'm hopefully trying to curb that a little bit so you don't make that mistake early on.
But you know, there's a second hidden benefit to building that content arsenal is that you get to use it too.
No doubt.
Put it on your website. Suddenly you've got all this great content.
Exactly. I mean, if I'm reaching out to an influencer and they say, well, do you have any product photos? I'm like, yeah, man, I got like 100. What do you need? Right, what kind of lighting do you need? Where, you know, do you want close up? Do you want landscape? Do you want people holding it? You know, I've got all that for you.
Or do you want the research study? Or do you want, you know?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it might be that they're like, you know what? I just, need to look at a couple things to get an example of your style because I'm going to go take my own pictures. Well, that's great. But you're giving them the background material, the asset they need to be able to do a great job for you.
Yeah. But don't reach out to people and try to under your the next one, deliver messages until you have the stuff ready to give to them. I would say almost immediately.
Right. And the deliver messages is twofold, just like defining the audiences is. You've got to deliver the message to the influencer, reach out to them, pitch them on the idea, negotiate, come up with, okay, we would like for you to do this and we'd like for you to be involved. What do you need to make that happen? And maybe it involves money, maybe it doesn't. But you've got to come to an agreement and deliver that message. But then you've got to help them deliver the message to their audience that you ultimately want the audience to hear. Because a lot of influencers, a lot of people, especially online influencers, a lot of people that you work with will be like, okay, well, I know what you want me to say. I'm going to go say it. But if they don't say it a certain way, you might know a little bit better on what's going to persuade that audience because they don't know your product as well as you do, right? So you got to work with them on messaging points and talking points and things like that. So there's two messages that you have to finesse there. You want to give the influencer ultimately the control because they know their audience better than you do, but you want to make sure that they're delivering the right messages about your product.
Right. And you write, if deep research to find the more right influence partners is where you save or at least avoid losing money, then deep research to nail your pitch to them is where you make money. So a certain amount of thought goes into this. And I had to laugh when you have examples here. And you, on one page, you write, I've found that simply introducing yourself and being honest about why you're connecting with them often works. Whoa! But wait. Jason Falls, I've just got to mention one other thing, because you have actually examples of emails that go out. Mm-hmm. And you say the goal of a pitch is a response. You're not trying to say, do you want to become our influencer? Do you want a lot of money? It's like the goal of the pitch is simply a response. It reminds me of the salesperson. When you make a contact call, you're trying to get the appointment. You're not trying to make a sale. And there was one email in here that you gave as an example. And it says, Jason Falls to Dude. This is on page 130. So I can only assume you were pitching the Big Lebowski. Yeah. And I've never gotten an email like this. And you write, it's really just two sentences. You write, hey, dude, can I send you a couple of bottles of bourbon to come to a product launch and write about it on your blog? Happy to hook you up. LMK Falls. Yeah.
That's an example of what I call the friend pitch. Now, I'm not going to send this to someone unless I know them.
Oh, okay. Okay.
This is how I would talk to someone who I've worked with before. I kind of know a couple
bottles. So you don't call just anyone dude.
No, I don't call just anybody dude. This is someone that I would know. There's another example on the page before that on 129 that's similar, but it's to someone I don't know. And so this one's to Samantha. It says, hi, Samantha. I'm working on an influencer engagement that would put a $3,000 entertainment center in your house. Interested? Jason.
Right.
And again, if you keep it short and simple and you're very clear about what you're trying to do, who you are, you don't have to, you know, it doesn't have to be paragraphs. It can be a couple sentences. All you really want for them is to say, yeah, I'm interested. Let's talk. Now you've got permission to do the, you know, too long, read later email, right? You've got permission to go into the details because now you have their attention. If you don't get their attention first, it's a fail all the way around.
Right. And because we mentioned Robert Cialdini's book, we have to mention what's on page 122. You talk about the gift of the golden phrase. Can you just quickly talk about, you know, if you're interested or, but you are free to choose.
Exactly. So, and the, if you're interested is my pet phrase when I'm pitching anyone. And I've been a PR guy for the better part of 25 years. And I've found this to be very successful. If you use, if you say, you know, here's what we're trying to do. I'd love for you to write about this, or I'd love to love to partner with you to communicate this, et cetera, et cetera. If at the end of your ask, you say, if you're interested, there's a psychological sort of letting off point that happens there for the person on the other end. Because if they're not interested, then they go, oh, well, I'm not interested. He must not really mean me. I'll move on with my life. No harm, no foul.
Well, and plus I don't like having to say no.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not interested. No big deal. And it makes it less confrontational if
yes.
they're not. But if they are, then like, well, yeah, I'm interested. Now, again, you have the permission. They've responded positively. You can continue. And so I asked Roger Dooley, who I think you've had on the show before as well. Roger's written a couple of really good books. He's my neuromarketing, my brain science buddy. And so I call Roger. When I'm trying to figure out the neuroscience behind things. And so I asked him if you're interested phrase would be, you know, kind of that psychological letting off. And he, you know, equated that to the BYAF, but you are free to choose, which has been tested around the world. And BYAF is actually an acronym in the advertising research world, because if you have that sort of psychological letting off point trigger in there that says, but you are free to choose, people tend to respond more positively because you've given them an option. If you're just saying, will you do this? I want you to do this for me. You're not really giving them an option. You're being more confrontational.
Yes.
But you are free to choose gives them the letting off point where they can say, okay, I'm really not interested. So thanks, but no thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very powerful. I mean, even with me, I get emails every once in a while and they're asking me these questions like, can they be on the show? And I'm like, well, can I see the book?
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of funny. So let's go to the very last one, which is about determined success and the remaining time. And I think one of the most important things, and we've already talked about, is to be smarter about measurement. You have to plan to measure. But just so the listener knows, there is all kinds of information about, there's all kinds of content in here about how to measure. And let me just ask you one quick question. Yeah, you say your goal is not a KPI, but you say that most people, that's like the number one question you get is about measurement. And let me just quote this. You write, measurement struggles across all marketing channels have always baffled me, to be honest. ROI is an accounting measure that determines what percentage of your spend you got back in revenue. You can't measure a financial return if you aren't trying to drive financial transactions. If you want to measure ROI on a campaign, then your goal has to be to drive sales. If your goal is something else, you cannot measure ROI. Most common problem I see in marketing managers who say they have trouble determining ROI is that their goals are not focused on revenue. Measuring ROI then becomes frustrating as they can't even get the proper numbers for their equation. They're asking the wrong question. So I can only imagine I've lit your fuse there. I didn't know if there's anything else you wanted to add to that.
Yeah, the ROI thing. I've been, you know, answering this question in some form or fashion, you know, for the better part of the last, you know, 15 years. When I started talking about social media and brands, they're like, what's the ROI of social media? And I was like, well, if your goal using social media is to drive revenue, then you can do the math. That's not hard. But you've got to set your messaging up so that you're driving people to convert, et cetera. But again, I challenge people who ask what is the ROI of influence marketing to step back and say, let's go back to number one, decide your goals. Yes. What are you using it for? If your goal is to use influencers to drive purchases, then you plan to measure purchases from influencer channels and the math happens. There are software packages, there are spreadsheets, There are calculators, and there are offshore people who will do math for you to make that all magic. If your goal is to drive awareness, that is not measured in dollars and cents. It is measured in the number of eyeballs you reach or the number of people who come to your website, etc. Now, you can correlate awareness to revenue. You can say, hey, we drove 25% more awareness numbers in our impressions, etc., and that equated to a 15% lift in revenue. You can correlate things all day. It might not be causation, but you can certainly draw correlations. But if your goal is to do something that is non-financial, then you cannot measure the return on investment because there's not a financial return.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are some people who will do some crazy magic math and say that a lead is worth this much money, which is probably valid because you can do some backwards math and figure out what a lead is worth to you. But there are some people who will say, well, an impression is worth this much money and a like on Facebook is worth this much money. And that is horseshit because a like is not going to pay your mortgage. A like is not going to make your salary numbers by the end of the month, right? What you've got to be able to do is say, our goals are these. You're going to have multiple goals, which is challenging because now you're going to dilute your decision making. But you say, we want to drive revenue. But in order to drive revenue, step down from a goal, one of our KPIs is impressions, awareness, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I like to say you have really one goal. Your goal, if driving revenue is the most important thing to you, that's your goal. Then you do a bunch of activities under that goal, a bunch of objectives that you know are going to lead to accomplishing that, like driving more eyeballs, driving more awareness, driving more impressions, etc. But I like to keep goals pretty singular because the more goals you add to the equation, the more confusion you have when you're asking those questions along the way of, does this ladder up to our goal?
Yes. Jason, let me just ask one other specific question about the book. And that is, we touched on just a moment ago when you talked about developing assets for an influencer. You can also use it for your own company. Mm-hmm. And I got the impression from the very last chapter that there are a number of companies that may be using the influencers to, that's the only content they're creating. Mm-hmm. And you write, quick, think of someone with influence who doesn't produce content. So I got the impression there are a lot of companies that still don't produce their own content. What are the benefits of them doing that?
Well, I mean, I would argue that, because I'm not just an influence marketer, I'm also a digital and social and, you know, marketer, that if you're not producing content of some sort, then you don't exist. People are not. They don't know who you are.
Yes.
But you can say, you know what? We're not good at creating content for social media, so we're going to engage influencers to create it for us. As long as you are, you know, getting the content from someone who is, building it for you and with your goals in mind, then you are creating content. That's your content, even though someone else is doing it. It's just like hiring a freelancer.
Mm-hmm.
But if you hire an online influencer, you can not only get the assets from them that you can use on your channels, but you can also have the advantage of getting those assets in front of their channels too. So it's kind of a neat sort of, you know, buy one, get one free sort of
right,
thing.
Right, right.
But yeah, there are a lot of companies out there too who, in one of the last chapters of the book, I talk about some examples of companies who are building their own influence. They're trying to, they're basically becoming influencers themselves by participating with the online communities that they're trying to reach the way other influencers are. Mark Meyer is a really good friend of mine. And one of the examples that he used, he worked for a B2B company several years ago, and they were, spending a lot of time and energy trying to build their brand on Twitter, and they weren't really getting a whole lot of traction. And so Mark just sort of sat there one night and said, well, let's look at what all the influential people in our space are doing on Twitter and see if we can just emulate that. And so he changed the way the company tweeted. He changed the frequency. He changed the type of content that they were sharing on Twitter. He added, tagging a bunch of people and adding hashtags and all of the best practices that people told you to do back in the day. This was 2005, 2006, whatever. Well, long story short, in about 3 months' time, they 10x'd their leads. They multiplied their revenue, and all these people, these lists that would come out of, you know, who's the most influential people in this industry, the brand started appearing on those lists because they had all these followers on Twitter. They had really high engagement rates. The other influencers in the space were tweeting them and talking to them and talking about them because they were participating in that social network the way an individual influencer would. And so now you've got companies out there that are smart about this that are saying, well, instead of spending a bunch of money paying someone who's already got an established audience to talk about us, let's spend some time and energy trying to achieve the same type of influence that that person has. Mm-hmm. And with some limited successes out there, you're seeing companies become influential in their own space.
Yeah, they don't have to be mutually exclusive.
No.
Yeah, you're right. He had, what is interesting to me, I underline this, when he was doing that, he incorporated third-party content 75% mm-hmm. of the time. Yep. And it's a great reminder of how you can build your influence by curating content.
Well, and back in the day, this, you know, in 2007, 2008, when Twitter was really first starting to take off, I actually wrote down on a piece of paper and tacked it to my, my little cork board in my office back then, Twitter strategy, : share good shit. And that was works. That was it. And you know,
did you include that in your book, The No Bullshit Guide to Social Media?
I'm fairly certain it's in there.
Because it seems like a natural. Yeah. Again, you know, I'm here to help.
but that strategy back then was, if I want to build, you know, an audience on Twitter, I've got to be useful. I've got to share good content. And so that was the only thing I really tried to do on Twitter for a long time. And at one point I had over 100,000 followers. I think with all of the algorithm changes and whatnot, I'm under that now, but I still have close to six figures of followers on Twitter. But it's because I never gamed the system. I never bought a follower. I never tried to do anything crazy. I just mm-hmm. tried to share good content.
Yeah.
And it became useful to people.
Right. You're right. Again, carve this in stone, folks. Create the type of content people are engaged with. Then, yes. while being careful not to abuse the privilege of their attention, you smartly build and or present them with awareness of or even calls to action for your product. So, Jason, if readers took only one thing away from the book, and I know it's not a fair question, what would you hope it would be?
I would hope that it would be that they realize that the peace sign duck lips folks out there is just a little sliver of what's possible in the influence marketing space, and that there are so many wonderful content creators, photographers, designers, writers, comedians, musicians. There's so many people out there creating fantastic content who are building vibrant, engaged audiences that your business or your brand can connect with. And I honestly feel like the influence marketing space is still on the uptick. We're still in the very early stages of this. It's still a very immature industry. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's a lot of what brands are going to be investing their dollars in over the course of the next decade. And I don't want businesses, small or large, to sit by the wayside and miss the opportunity to find some great relationships with some great influential people out there, online or offline, that can help them move the needle for their business. So give influencers and give influence marketing a chance, and ignore what the mainstream media likes to talk about, because all they publish are those, you know, train wreck rubberneck things that say this influencer photoshopped clouds on their thing and blah, blah,
blah, blah. Or the Fry Festival.
Exactly. All that's, that's the fringe of the bad. You're missing out on the entirety of the good if yeah. that's all you see.
Really well said. And if I could offer a suggestion to the listener, let's say try to find an example of another company. Maybe there's not one in your vertical yet, which is fine. That's a great thing. But show an example of something more closely aligned to your business or industry that is doing it. And I think that would help people understand what it is. Because otherwise, all you're doing is forcing them to think about the duck face peace sign person that their kids may have been talking about. So,
well said.
What is one thing a listener could do today just to kind of take that first step to put in action one of the many ideas from your book or one that we've talked about?
Ask an influencer to come on your podcast or do a live interview with them, live stream interview on Facebook. Just have somebody who's got an audience, do something simple and easy for them. All they got to do is answer questions. What are they going to do with that content? They're going to share it.
Yes.
Now you've practiced influence marketing.
Yes. That's like taking a little sample at the distillery. And then you go, yes, I think I'd like a glass of that.
Exactly.
It all comes back to bourbon, you know. At least when you're talking to Jason Falls anyway. So, Jason, looking back, what books have most inspired your work and career?
Oh, my goodness. That's a good one. Well, I have to go back to the whole topic of word-of-mouth marketing, because that sort of topic is what inspired me to have a little bit of a career pivot. You know, I said before I was a PR guy in college athletics for about 15 years, kind of a sports journalist background. And I got out of that into the mainstream marketing world after reading the book Brand Hijack by Alex Wipperfirth.
Oh, wow.
That was the first book that I read that I was like, I want to figure out how to do this.
Ah.
And it was really, it wasn't specifically word of mouth marketing. It was the more broad concept of, I don't want to write or produce advertisements. I want to find interesting ways to connect brands with consumers. And that was about the same time brands were starting to raise their hand and ask questions about social media. And so that, you know, Brand Hijack was one. I think
that's Brand Hijack, Marketing Without Marketing.
Yep.
Looks like it came out in 2006. I did not know that one. I appreciate you telling us about that.
That's a good one. And Emmanuel Rosen's Anatomy of Buzz came out about the same time, actually a few years before. I think Anatomy of Buzz was probably one of the first word-of-mouth marketing books. And that book also sort of was another that inspired me to think a little bit differently about how companies communicate with their audiences. And so those two books were pivotal in moving me toward where I am now, but probably the one that really solidified this is what I'm going to be doing with the rest of my career was The New Rules of Marketing and PR by the guy who wrote my foreword, David Meerman Scott.
Wow. You and me both, brother. Mm-hmm. Seriously, there are two books that have had the biggest impact on my career. And the first one was Ogilvy on Advertising.
Yep.
I read that after I got out of the Army, came back to the United States, and I said, that's what I want to do. And then that whole advertising thing, as you know, has become a shadow of its former self, and mm-hmm. everything changed. And I started thinking, wait a minute, this is the whole gravy train stopping. Wait a minute, I love this business. And then I read one of the early editions of David Meerman Scott's book. I felt like that, just like you said, solidified it. It's like it showed me where the whole world was going. And it was so amazing. I felt like I had another bite at the career apple, and I went off in that direction. And that is why I asked this question, because the right book at the right time can have such a dramatic effect on your career trajectory and also your life. Wow, that's great.
Well, and I would also say especially to the younger folks out there, don't overlook a book because it was published in 2005. Brand Hijack, you know, Word of Mouth Marketing, Anatomy of Buzz, New Rules of Marketing and PR, which is in its like seventh or eighth edition now.
Seventh, yeah.
Some of these books, Ogilvy on Advertising is, you know, 40 years old or whatever. I mean, my mom had that on the bookshelf when I was a kid. you know, don't give up on those books because they're older. There's a lot of great inspiration in there, even though there may not be some real world, practical, right today, tactical things in it. The strategic thinking and the thinking behind it is going to inspire you.
Yes. And, you know, there's one called Scientific Advertising, which came out about 98 years ago by Claude Hopkins. He also wrote My Life in Advertising, and those books are still applicable. Mm-hmm. You know, How to Win Friends and Influence People, written in 1936. Yeah. No doubt. Even the book we talked about, Influence, written in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's great advice for the kids out there. It's great advice for anybody, really. So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or have heard of that you're looking forward to reading or seeing come out?
Oh man, there's so many people out there working on projects. It's kind of hard to keep track of them. You know, we talked about Talk Triggers from Jay Baer, which has been out for a couple of years now. Anything Jay Baer writes is probably going to be pretty damn good.
Yeah, if there's a way to go on Amazon and just tell them, send me anything. He's one of those authors. Just go ahead and bill me. Just send me whatever book they write. Yeah.
Yeah. And from a persuasion perspective, and understanding how to communicate, you know, very effectively with your audience, Tamsin Webster's The Red Thread, Find Your Red Thread, is new. It's been out for about a month and absolutely fantastic. And Tamsin's someone from the marketing world who has spent much of the last probably decade teaching people how to do TED Talks and really find that thread of the message and what you're trying to say to deliver the right message to the audience. Fantastic book. I'd highly recommend it.
Absolutely. She is one of the most interesting people. And I noticed you quoted her husband, Tom Webster, in your book. And I actually got to interview her about that. And it's an episode that's published. So I'll include a link to that. It is such an interesting book. Yeah. I'm going to read it a second time.
It's useful. Very useful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. So at marketingbookpodcast.com, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to include links to everything that is linkable, you know, all the books you've mentioned, your site, your agency site, your LinkedIn profile. And listener, if you would do me a big, big favor, please reach out to Jason Falls and thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. He spent a lot of time with us and he's kind of a big deal. And these authors who are on the show absolutely love hearing from folks who listen to the Marketing Book Podcast. So you can reach out to him on social. You can go to his website, sign up for some more information. And you've got a resource section for your book. Mm-hmm. So it's absolutely terrific. Please do that. And also, you know, if you're listening on your smartphone right now and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on the show notes link. The book is Winfluence, Reframing Influencer Marketing to Ignite Your Brand. The author is Jason Falls. Jason, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Douglas. Thank you.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who have left an iTunes review, let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world and I'll drop it in the mail. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And remember the words of the entrepreneur and author Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune." Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.